Hello, and welcome to the March 2019 InfoTech Threat Landscape Briefing. My name is Jessica Ireland, and I'm a director in our Security and Threat Intelligence practice. I will be facilitating today's briefing. During today's discussion, we will cover topics related to cybersecurity, threat actor campaigns, regulatory compliance and legal issues, and threat actor exploits and tactics. Our cybersecurity section covers high-level topics such as threat trends, data breaches, control strategies, and exposure to vulnerabilities that act to broaden your understanding of cybersecurity's impact to your business. Our threat actor campaign section covers topics related to nation states, cyber criminals, and hacktivists orchestrating campaigns designed to compromise networks and exfiltrate sensitive data. Our regulatory compliance and legal section covers trends in the global regulatory and legal landscape, with the potential to impact compliance adherences or disrupt business operations. And lastly, our exploitation and tactics section provides information related to the tools, tactics, and exploits threat actors are leveraging in their attack campaigns. Today's briefing will be supported by myself, Senior Research Analyst Rita Zerbrig, Research Analyst Ian Mulholland, and Research Specialist Logan Rohde and Michelle Tran. During today's briefing, we will cover the following topics: how the U.S. government shutdown affected cybersecurity, Huawei CFO's arrest plus security allegations, Facebook and Google's abusing Apple's root certificate policy and users' privacy compromise, cryptojacking replaces ransomware as the hot malware, banks' effort to recover money allegedly stolen by North Korea. Let's begin. The 2019 government shutdown affected almost everything, so it's no surprise that it had an impact on cybersecurity. The record-long shutdown, 35 days, was costly for the U.S. in terms of time and money lost, not just related to the workers who weren't paid. The congressional budget estimates it cost the U.S. economy about $11 billion. When it came to cybersecurity, the shutdown created some stalls. At the Department of Homeland Security, its Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, failed to really get going when it was supposed to as a result of the shutdown, having only really started in mid-November 2018. Other activities suspended during the shutdown included pipeline security, botnets, election security, and more. With the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency on hold, any forward-thinking moves around cybersecurity were halted, which means catching up could take months or years in terms of initiatives and investigations. On the other hand, some reports noted that some cybersecurity efforts actually improved, particularly around endpoint protection and patching. The reason behind this is simply that fewer government employees meant fewer individuals online, which reduced the overall risk to government cybersecurity. As Alex Hyde, Chief Research Officer at Security Scorecard, was quoted as saying to Fifth Domain, "We saw a drop in internet traffic coming from .gov during the shutdown. This made the government less of an exploitable attack vector." Also, patching was reported to be up by 1.38%. According to Security Scorecard, security professionals were still working, even without pay, to continue patching efforts. And with less traffic occurring, it made patching easier. Finally, to the second area where cybersecurity efforts saw some improvement, endpoint protection increased 9.16%. This was related again to the decrease in traffic and decrease in devices that were turned on. As mentioned, the long-term effects of the shutdown will be felt in 2019, well into 2019 and beyond. Not only were important initiatives through CISA delayed, hiring efforts were stalled and will be even further behind than they already were. And these are already a struggle across all industries. According to cyberseek.org, a National Institute for Cybersecurity Education tool, the DC Metro workforce has 3,709 positions to fill for cybersecurity public sector workers. The shutdown doesn't make the government a particularly attractive option for cybersecurity professionals.
The arrest of Huawei's CFO, Meng Wanzhou, has ignited the most recent battle between the United States and China. While Canada remains in the middle as the country that has detained the CFO. For those who aren't familiar, Huawei is a Chinese multinational telecommunications equipment and consumer electronics manufacturer. Wanzhou, as the CFO, is accused of skirting U.S. sanctions against Iran and faces multiple counts of fraud charges and conspiracy to defraud financial institutions. Ultimately, if she is convicted, she'll face up to 30 years of jail time for each of the charges. Alternatively, China stipulates that neither Canada or the U.S. has provided any evidence that a crime was committed. And as a countermeasure, Huawei has most recently sued the U.S. government. While much can be said about the heated battle between the U.S. and Huawei, we've summarized some of the key points along the timeline. Note, we won't be able to cover everything today, but we'll continue to monitor the threat that Huawei may pose to U.S. organizations. So let's begin at the beginning. In 1982, 5 years after leaving the Chinese military, Ren Zhengfei founded Huawei, an organization in the telco industry that was focused on rapid growth and expansion. Less than 20 years later, during the early internet era, Huawei had expanded all across mainland China and had begun to build research facilities in the United States. During this time, their North American expansion wasn't focused on the United States, but was in fact focused on Canada. Early R&D spend was focused in one area, the province of British Columbia. This is interesting because this also happens to be the location in which Wen Zhu was arrested. Skipping ahead as we approach the second decade of the 20th century, Huawei increasingly experienced criticism and was often accused of espionage and stealing various organizational trade secrets. In 2012, a U.S. congressional panel warned that Huawei and its rival ZTE posed a security threat, following an intense investigation. 2 years later, in 2014, Huawei was banned from bidding on any U.S. government contracts after espionage concerns were again raised. However, these accusations did not stop the organization from growing. Just last year, Huawei surpassed Apple as the second largest smartphone maker in the world. For some countries in the West, specifically Australia and New Zealand, the volume of products and the expansion of Huawei did not thwart their security concerns. These two countries have explicitly banned Huawei from bidding on any contracts that deal with building and expanding their 5G networks. Ultimately, this all came to a head when Wen Zhu was arrested in December 2018. She has been released on bail and is actively fighting these charges, but has yet to be extradited to the United States. Meanwhile, publicity for Huawei has continued to grow, and many countries actively debate on whether or not to allow the organization to bid on contracts that deal with their core infrastructure, specifically the much-anticipated 5G network. To add one more ingredient into this mix, other analysts believe that this is all part of a much broader plan to stir up controversy related to the ongoing trade war between the United States and China. While endorsement and validation for those that have been accused Huawei continues to grow in the West, here at Infotech, we'll keep you updated on all the Huawei-related news as it continues to develop, specifically the security concerns that you may face in your organization.
Tech giants have been in the news so much lately, it's hard to follow all the stories and keep track of the growing pile of privacy concerns they're creating. From data breaches to data scandals, it seems like we've seen it all. Nevertheless, Facebook and Google were in the news again, this time for releasing apps that monitored users' data very closely, and in the case of Facebook, very, very closely. And Apple was not happy about it. In fact, they had previously removed Facebook's product from the App Store for being too invasive. So how did Facebook distribute this app in the first place? Well, Facebook managed to get around Apple's ban by using their enterprise certificate to send the app directly to users, rather than having them download it through the App Store. However, this special certificate issued by Apple is only supposed to be used to distribute apps within the companies that develop them, mainly for testing and internal use purposes. The app, simply known as Research, was released with the intention of better understanding how Facebook users interact with their phones. But the app revealed this information by monitoring all data transfer to and from the device it was installed on, including things that would otherwise be encrypted. Facebook has claimed that the app did not violate any ethical boundaries because users consented to data collection as part of the installation and were paid $20 a month to use the app. However, it is not clear that users were well informed of just how deep this data monitoring was going to go. This is of particular concern because the app is known to have been used by teens. Officially, teens were required to obtain parental permission before using the app, but it does not seem that Facebook verified that permission had actually been granted. In order to use the app, users had to accept Facebook's root access certificate, which more or less embedded the app within the code of the user's smartphones. users also had to agree to Facebook's VPN provision. VPNs, or virtual private networks, are usually associated with privacy protection, but this one's a little different. In principle, it is a VPN, but in typical cases, a VPN routes traffic through a third party to conceal a connection's origin, thus enhancing users' privacy. It would be possible for the third party to snoop on the data users are sending through its network, but it would undermine the company's business model, so it doesn't usually happen. Facebook, however, was using their VPN for precisely this purpose. As a result, Facebook could see all data entering or exiting users' phones. But Facebook was not alone. Google's ScreenWise Meter app was designed with pretty much the same purpose in mind, except instead of cash, they paid their users in gift cards. Google also misused their enterprise certificate to distribute their app, and they likewise required users to grant the app special access to their phones, including VPN installation. But unlike Facebook's app, Google's was not set up to collect data before it was encrypted, meaning they did not collect the most sensitive information users may have been entering into their phones. Google's app was therefore less invasive than Facebook's, though Apple really wasn't any happier with them and decided to revoke the enterprise certificates for both Facebook and Google, meaning that all apps associated with those certificates would no longer work. This caused minimal disruption for Facebook and Google, and both had their certificates restored within 2 days. Still, Apple shot across the bow to both Facebook and Google, very clearly made their position on these issues known, and in so doing sent a warning to other companies against misusing enterprise certificates in similar ways. And word has it, Facebook and Google were not alone in this practice.
Cryptojacking is the act of using somebody else's computer to mine cryptocurrency. While the unsuspecting person uses their computer, this code runs in the background. The only noticeable symptom of this infection is a lower than normal performance of the computer. Unfortunately, it is relatively simple to execute cryptojacking attacks, as they require little technical skill, and software can be purchased for low prices on the dark web, according to Digital Shadows. In July of last year, crypto miners were reported to have taken 4 spots of the top 10 pieces of malware found by Checkpoint Software Technologies. Cryptojacking is becoming an enticing alternative to ransomware, simply because it is more efficient and carries less risk. While a low percentage of those infected with ransomware actually pay the ransom, all machines infected with cryptojacking software work to generate money for the hacker. The more low profile the software is, the longer it will go unnoticed, and the more money that infection event will make for the hacker. There is also less risk. Because these infections can go unnoticed for so long, finding the source of the infection becomes more difficult. With ransomware, people are made aware of the infection when it occurs. And since nothing was stolen or encrypted by the hacker during a cryptojacking attack, there is a lack of motivation for the victim to pursue them.
In 2016, nearly $1 billion was fraudulently requested from Bangladesh Bank, an account managed by the New York branch of the U.S. Central Bank. Using the SWIFT Global Payments Network, hackers were able to transfer $81 million to a Filipino bank, Ritzel Commercial Bank Corporation, RCBC, and later into Filipino casinos before being interrupted. Of the $81 million, only $15 million was recovered. In February of this year, Bangladesh filed a lawsuit in New York against RCBC, alleging that the Philippines collaborated with North Korea in the Bank East. Knowing that North Korea was short of funds and an outcast from the global rule of law, Bangladesh Bank sued the Filipino bank in hopes of recovering from their losses. RCBC attorneys deny allegations of conspiracy with North Korea and believe that Bangladesh Bank is trying to shift the blame in place of their own negligence. Seeing as the money transfers took place outside of Asia, why did Bangladesh file a lawsuit in the United States? Their reason is twofold. First, Bangladesh Bank emphasizes that the New York Federal Reserve's wire system played a large role in the hackers' plan. And second, that the U.S. courts will be able to resolve the lawsuit in a fair manner, as they are known to offer clearer legal processes and governing laws than other countries. The bank case is linked to threat actors compromising the credentials of a SWIFT operator at Bangladesh Bank installing malware to overcome fraud detection controls. While the exact means of infiltration into Bangladesh Bank is not completely understood, the key defense against cyber attacks is having a strategy that involves both user training and appropriate security measures. For more information on the Bangladesh Bank heist, please visit the link below.
This concludes our monthly threat briefing. If you have any questions or need any support on any of these topics, please do not hesitate to contact us to set up an analyst call. Thank you, and see you next month.